and Ancient Theosophy and Western Thought. We'll have two short presentations and then plenty of time for questions and discussions. The first talk will be the earlier of the two in time, and we'll be looking at Neoplatonism and the Alexandria schools. This is a massive undertaking for anybody to do a study on this. There is so much in regards to philosophy, personages, ideas. So we are just going to be narrowing it down. We'll be looking at the background of Neoplatonism in the schools. We'll be discussing, of course, Plato and how he was involved with all of this, and also Ammonius Saccas and Hypatia. It's like the beginning and the end. So we're continuing, as we said, our study for the month regarding these ideas of ancient theosophy and its connection with different ideas and areas of thought. And what the attempt is to show how theosophy is not a new belief, but how it is ancient in its scope and can be seen in pretty much all of the religious doctrines. This was one of the things that was an effort on these philosophers, was to prove, especially to Christianity, how these ideas did pertain to all religions, if one would take the religions back to their essence, to their beginnings. So the Neoplatonists then, obviously it's named for Plato, and Neoplatonist is a more recent new name. It's not one that was used back in ancient times. So Plato was born and he died in Greece. They're not exactly sure when he was born, 427 or 428 BC. And he died either in 347 or 348 BC. And his philosophy was universals to particulars. And he claimed to have no original thoughts when it came to the philosophy, to his ideas. But his whole thing was to unify the ancient truths from Socrates, Pythagoras, Patanjali's, from Buddha, the idea of emanation. And he also discussed the idea of being and the idea of thought, which is the ideal. We do have... to some of his philosophy, it's like talking about theosophy, basically. We can see where the theosophical philosophy has been brought forward from Plato. He talked about the higher self in man, about how this higher self makes a man. He talked about the existence of the causeless cause. He described the universal substratum of primordial substance as the unlimited, the indefinable something from which all forms of matter emanate and to which they will eventually return. He talked about the concept of space and ceaseless eternal motion. He talked about will. He talked about the universal intelligence, universal mind. He talked about the immortality of the soul. So, and he said the soul is neither dependent upon the body for its existence nor affected by its dissolution. He talked about reincarnation and karma. So there's so much of what Plato spoke of that we can take back to him from theosophy. So then we have this, so then what happened after Plato left the scene? Then we have the Alexandrian schools came forward, and it was named for Alexander the Great, who was a pupil of Aristotle. He began the erection of the city in 331 BC, but unfortunately he died before it was completed in 323 BC. And it housed some of the greatest minds in the world. These mystery schools were highly religious, scientific, and philosophical, teaching ethics. But the one that is most interesting to theosophists is the one where 1,500 years ago, and again, we're looking at a cycle of 1,500 years, which was begun by Ammonius Saccas. And it ended with the murder of Hypatia. One interesting quote that Ammonius said was, "Why do not the Christians realize that all religions have sprung from a common source? That is our work." So even back then, they were talking about what kind of work they needed to do, what they needed to spread broadcast. So this is now known as the Neoplatonic school. And as we said, it's a modern name. It wasn't one that was used back in the day. So the Neoplatonic schools were founded in 193 AD. And its aim was to blend religion, philosophy, and science from the East and the West by taking them back to their origins under a common basis. And this is something that modern day theosophy has brought forward as well. These schools were based on three ideas. One, that the whole of nature is rooted in one supreme essence. Two, that the soul of man, being a radiation of the universal soul, is immortal. And three, that man, by self-purification, can become a god in human form. So we know, what this sounds like, this is pure theosophy. And after the death of Ammonius Saccas, the school flourished by some very dedicated souls. And in ancient landmarks, there was an interesting piece. It says the Christian church was opposed to the Neoplatonic movement from its beginning. The Christians taught a personal God, the Neoplatonists an impersonal principle. The Christians regarded the universe as a creation of God. The Neoplatonists declared it to be an emanation of the supreme essence. Christianity claimed to be a unique religion. The Neoplatonists pointed to the source of all religions. Several prominent church fathers were drawn into the Neoplatonic movement, but their efforts to reconcile Neoplatonism with Christianity met with little success. And the interesting part we thought was that there was this deadlock between science and Orthodox Christianity, mainly around the shape of the earth. The scientists, of course, believed that it was round. The Christians felt as though it was flat. And this became quite a stumbling block between the Christians and science. And also the pagan philosophers, the Neoplatonist teachings, had to be refuted. In order to stabilize the disputes, the church decided to open their own school in Alexandria to spread Christianity. And in 529, Justinian closed the school, the Neoplatonic schools, and exiled or killed the last of them. So we'll look at Ammonius Saccas. He was born in Alexandria into a very devout, poor Christian family. His family insisted that he go to the Christian schools that were in Alexandria. And because they were so poor, as well as going to school, he worked on the docks. And it is believed that he may have picked up some diverse ideas from the people that he met on these docks. So he began asking questions in his Christian school, and the priests weren't very happy with that. They told him to believe, but he wanted to know. And at one point, he actually left the school and began his own investigations. He began to study the pagan teachings, and pagan just means you're not believing in religion. So he was looking at the Neoplatonic ideas, and he felt as though these were the real ideas. So he started the Neoplatonic school in Alexandria in 193. So his objects as well are definitely seen as being theosophical in nature. His first was to form the nucleus of universal brotherhood with no exceptions on every plane. Two, he felt that the only way to unite all religions was to show the same source of it all. He explained the existence of the ancient ideas and how all religions sprang from it. He put forth the idea of comparative studies of the religions and philosophies of all nations. And three, to make the study of philosophy a living power in people's lives, using the method of analogy and correspondence. So again, these ideas, analogy and correspondence, making it a living power in your life, all of these, to unite all religions under one idea, these are all those of theosophy. So when we're talking about the ancient ideas, ancient theosophy, and Western thought, we can definitely see how theosophy came forward. And he talked about a single supreme being, unknowable and unknown. And he divided his school into exoteric and esoteric teachings. Ammonius Saccas did not put anything in writing. His students were the ones that spread these ideas, Plotinus, Porphyry, and Iamblichus. So Hypatia is the last philosopher we'll discuss. So when Christianity became a Western, in the Western world during the fourth century, it was definitely a political organization. It put down the old religions, it put down sciences and philosophies. And it was in this type of climate that Hypatia became active. She was born into a well-to-do family that studied philosophy and mathematics. Her father wrote a lecture on Euclid, and she actually, even as a young woman, was able to help him. He noticed his only child's gifts and taught her all he knew. And unfortunately, many of her writings are now lost as well. She became involved with the Neoplatonist movement while living in Athens. And after she moved to Alexandria, she began teaching. She began lecturing all these ideas and was considered to be a major force because of her profound wisdom and her intelligence. And all this despite the fact that she was a relatively young woman at this time, and she was a woman, as well, which was very unusual back then. And she really began to enlighten Egypt that hadn't been seen for a very long time. And she followed the ideas of Ammonius Saccas, and she wanted to show the idea of the similarities between all religions and where that source came from. And she put out the ideas of Plotinus and Porphyry regarding the union of the individual self with the self of all. And she lectured openly about metaphysical allegories that Christianity had borrowed from its teachings. And she used this as a weapon against the Christians. And it was as if the only response from them would be violence. And on Lent of 414, Cyril's monks murdered her violently on the church's altar. With her death, the Neoplatonic school came to an end, and it marked the beginning of the Dark Ages. But interestingly enough, 1,500 years later, in 1914, the World War of the Christian Nations began. So that's it for Alexandria and the Neoplatonists. So we will have another talk.
So we are going to try to talk about, in about 10 minutes or a little more perhaps, the period of the fall of Rome, 476, up to the death of the most famous heretic of the late Middle Ages, Giordano Bruno, in the year 1600. So if you do your math here, that's 1,126 years in 10 minutes. So we can't possibly, do it justice, but we're going to talk about three individuals and just touch on a couple of names and a couple of sentences of some other individuals because they were conduits, as it were. So as the first speaker said, the term Neoplatonism didn't come about until the 1800s when they were examining all the teachings. So by then, most of the teachings had been translated from the Greek to the Latin and then to other languages. And then there were scholars that could read in the original language instead of going through two or three intermediary languages, which of course, as we all know, something is always lost in translation. So first we're going to talk about Ancilius Manlius Severinus Boethius, who is known as Boethius. He was born into a Roman aristocracy. He was probably the last true Greek scholar of that era, and he had a classical education. However, right around the time of his birth, the fall of Rome occurred, and Theodoric, who was the Western Goth, the Visigoth king, and as time went on, he actually became king of the Ostrogoths as well. So he was king of the whole Gothic kingdom. He was actually royalty too, but of course he just deposed the last Roman ruler. He kept all the trappings, though. He kept the Senate. He didn't completely do the infrastructure all over again. And he actually ruled from 220 miles away. So Boethius was a great scholar. and a synthesizer of ideas. And he made things accessible for what was then the modern world. However, unfortunately, the ruler, the king, became either jealous of him or suspicious. He thought that he was, at this time we had the Eastern and the Western Roman Empire. They were pretty well split in half. So Theodoric suspected Boethius of treachery. And we think also there was jealousy because he was so popular and so intelligent. But he had a gift for making these philosophical ideas dramatic and accessible to the wider public. He was enormously influential in the Middle Ages. He drew upon the thinking of the Greek Neoplatonists such as Porphyry and Iamblichus. But he also made his own contributions as an independent thinker. And one reason that Neoplatonism, it's a good term to use, because there was a synthesis from the original Plato over the years. So, about 1,000 years had taken place during this period. And we had, we have the Gnostics, we have the Jews, we have the Christians, we have the Essenes, we have all these trends and influences, threads, as it were, that have been all tied up. So there's an evolution of ideas. So Neoplatonism is definitely distinct from Platonism. It's more metaphysical in a way. It's more mystical. It took on more mystical elements than was present in Platonism. So Boethius was sentenced to death, and he was tortured and murdered, of course. He wrote in his last year in prison, he wrote The Consolation of Philosophy, which was a very influential, it's still influential, but it was like the most influential text on philosophy for over 1,000 years. And it did influence the early modern thinkers as well. And so it's very similar in many respects to the Bhagavad Gita. At first he's feeling sorry for himself, and why me? And then he terms philosophy as the gray-eyed lady. And this gray-eyed lady comes to visit him and basically says, well, why not you? And look at all that you have, look at all the good you've had in life too. And the good times, the bad times, they all pass. You want to read here a couple of quotes from Boethius. It is my belief that history is a wheel. Inconstancy is my very essence, says the wheel. Rise up on my spokes if you like, but don't complain when you're cast back down into the depths. Good times pass away, but then so do the bad. Mutability is our tragedy, but it is also our hope. The worst of times, like the best, are always passing away. So his book is still in print, and there's several translations. And as we said, it follows the same kind of trajectory that the Bhagavad Gita does. So skipping ahead here, into the darkest depths of the Dark Ages. We have John's Scotus Origina, who lived from about 800 until about 877. The name Scotus throws people off. It was actually from Ireland, because Ireland was known as Scottish Major back then. It wasn't always called Ireland. So it's very confusing when you start reading about him. But Origina means of Ireland. So his name actually means John the Irishman from Ireland. So it's redundant. The Origina is actually redundant. But of course, words change over time. And it's what's really interesting, what we found in the study, was that since Ireland was not conquered by the Roman Empire, it was kind of doing its own thing. And a lot of scholars fled persecution and they landed up on the shores of Ireland. But during his lifetime, the Danes, the Vikings invaded Ireland, so there was turmoil. But he had a classical Greek education in Ireland. He was a secular figure. He was not an ordained priest. That's doubly rare here. Mr. Judge writes about Ireland, how ancient a place it is. Origina suggests the Greek name suggesting the Greek name for Erin, Irina, and that means the sacred isle. So John Origina, he went to the court of Charles the Bald, who was a Western Frankish king. And he has some influence in his lifetime. He translated many works into Latin, because that was from Greek to Latin, because that was the language of that scholars used for many, many years. He wrote a book called On the Divisions of Nature. He actually wrote quite a bit. And he had a minor influence during his day, but later on, he had a much greater influence on thinkers like 2-3 centuries later. So his ideas were eventually declared heretical, of course. But so his thought is best understood as a sustained attempt to create a consistent, systematic Christian Neoplatonism, which is from diverse sources. He had a unique gift of identifying the underlying intellectual framework, broadly Platonic, but also deeply Christian, assumed by writers of the Christian East. Origina develops a Neoplatonic cosmology according to the infinite, transcendent, and unknown God, who is beyond being and non-being through a process of self-articulation, procession, or self-creation, which proceeds from divine darkness or non-being into the light of being, speaking the word, that's with a capital W, who is understood as Christ, and at the same timeless moment, bringing forth primary causes of all creation. Okay, so he talks about various, the reality of nature, that nature is one, that God and nature are one, and many other things. And he had a great influence. Then hundreds of years later, his writings were rediscovered, as it were, in the 14th and 15th centuries by Meister Eckhart, and especially Nicholas of Cusa. So the last one, but we're skipping ahead now to the end of the Middle Ages, to Giordano Bruno. But we need to mention in passing that Renaissance, of course, was kicked off in the interim. So this is the early Renaissance. It had been going on for approximately 100 years. There was an effort to reconcile the schism between the East and Western churches. And so there was a delegation that went to Florence, and where the Medicis were the rulers. And so we have a delegation from the East, and again, a secular person, which was a secular scholar, was the most influential. And his name was George Gemistas Plethon. And he lived to be about 100 years old and died right before Constantinople fell to the Turks. He died just 1 year before in 1452. So he lived from approximately 1355 to 1452 in the last days of the Byzantine Empire. But because of his influence, Cosimo de' Medici picked Marsilio Ficino to found a school and to translate all these ancient works that are that were highly influential. And of course, the modern expression of the Theosophical movement was started by Tsongkhapa, who we've talked about quite a bit in the past. And he gathered together all the adepts and kicked out the sham adepts, the sham monks, and he reformed Buddhism and started the Gelugpa, or the Yellow Cap sect. But that influence, that theosophical impulse, in 100 years, it gravitated, and manifested itself as the Renaissance in Italy, which of course spread throughout Europe over time. So we have the probably the most famous heretic by far of the Middle Ages, coming to life in the personage of Giordano Bruno, who was an ordained Dominican priest, monk, but he became disenchanted, and he was a free thinker and a questioner, and he ended up leaving his orders, ended up being defrocked. He actually went to Switzerland, and the Calvinists excommunicated him, and basically the Lutherans did the same thing. He was in England, and they didn't like him, but he had great respect for Elizabeth I, who was a very intelligent and actually far-thinking woman. So Giordano Bruno talked about infinite universes. He talked about the monad. He talked about, life is in everything. We have had talks about him in the past. He also tried to reconcile the different strains of Christianity. He wanted to try to bring a synthesis together. He worked in England and France and tried to, he ended up in the hands of the Inquisition, to make a long story short, and he would not recant, and he was burned at the stake in 1600. So he incorporated Zoroastrianism and the Kabbalah and many other things. He was, he talked about the universe and the atom. the universal soul, universal intellect, and universal matter. He identified various principles. So of course, we're just touching on things here. Maybe a couple of quick quotes. He says, Giordano Bruno, truth does not change because it is or it is not believed by a majority of the people. All things in the universe and the all things are in the universe and the universe in all things. We are in it and it is in us. In this way, everything occurs in perfect unity. God is infinite, so his universe must be too. Thus is the excellence of God magnified and the greatness of his kingdom made manifest. He is glorified not in one, but in countless suns, not in a single earth, in a single world, but in a thousand thousand, I say an infinity of worlds. The fools of the world have been those who have established religions, ceremonies, laws, faith, rule of life. So we can see even today, he would meet his detractors, perhaps not burn at the stake, but efforts would be made to marginalize his ideas. So we welcome questions, comments, contributions at this time. TK?
The first speaker early in the presentation said that Plato taught of the doctrine of emanations. Why is that important, and what's the implication of that? Or could we just talk about what that is?
Well, our understanding of the doctrine of emanations is the idea that the one, that deific principle that Theosophy speaks of, that all manifestation emanates from it, that it does not emanate, but causes manifestation to come forth. So things are emanating from it, but it is not emanating.
S.L., you had your hand up.
It's interesting regarding Giordano Bruno that there is a statue to him in Rome, in the courts there. But also, we thought that in recent years, the church did issue an apology on the anniversary, I guess 500th anniversary or 400th anniversary of his death, for what had happened to him.
Yeah. Paul II issued an apology in a way, but it was not a, he still said he is an irremediable heretic. So apologized for the actions of the church in putting him to death, but that his ideas will never be compatible, even close to Roman Catholicism as we know it today. So that was 1,400 years after the fact, but an irremediable heretic. So hopeless in their eyes. TK?
Actually, we kind of see that as a compliment. And we don't mean that disrespectfully to the church, but the word heretic means free thinker. And if you're an irremediable free thinker, well then, so be it. There's a lot to be said about that.
Right, but most people don't know that.
Well, it's like the word pagan. You know, most people look at pagans as running around, hugging trees, you know, free love, all of that. But pagan just means one who doesn't believe in religion. So it's strange how things can change over years.
LT.
Good morning. I do have a pot of coffee if anybody wants it, but I want to comment on that. And just 2 days ago, I ran on something on YouTube about Bach Saga, and it talked about an Aryan race thousands of years ago before Plato came around. And it's interesting how this was a pagan culture and a society that had moved from the most north to the south. But it's interesting how the pagan religion and the unity of the feminine and the male god has been perverted by the Christian religion for time. And it's interesting how theosophy in nature does come through thousands of years as it goes from north, it goes to the south, east to the west, and comes right back to where it started from. In a bloody battle with a lot of million people dead over that. And it definitely shows through history how this has been perverted. It doesn't take one person to prove this, but it takes multitude through the hundreds of years. And that's my, thank you.
The contribution.
Because we know that Plato felt as though all life, not just human life, but all life was sacred. And that emanation that came from deity, we are all of that emanation. So he talked about all these different strata that needs to be not honored, but everything is from deity. Everything. And it is, that is what the basis of universal brotherhood is.
We just wanted to mention that Giordano Bruno traveled all over Europe, and he was a favorite of the ruler of the West Franks, Charles the Bald. But after he died, he went to England. But his stock in trade as a secular intellectual was a system of memory, which is still available. It's called a memory palace. If you want to Google that, his name or memory palace, there's an awful lot about it. And it's more than just, it's not really rote learning. So there's a distinction to be made between mnemonics and just memorizing stuff and mindlessly. So we just wanted to mention that about that. That's how he supported himself for all those years. But then that trap was laid for him and he was captured and taken to the Inquisition. And there was an 8-year period where he was tortured and they wanted him to recant and he never did. So he's considered a hero of many, actually, of many people, of free thinkers in general, look up to him with great respect.
Well, one thing that Hypatia said was, all formal dogmatic religions are fallacious and must never, and she used the word never, never be accepted by self-respecting persons as final.
MDW, unmute.
Now, we're talking about individuals who have talked in terms of this wisdom religion, but there were also groups of people who live these ideas. One in particular in the 12th century, or 11th or 13th century, I'm not sure, the Cathars or Cathars of southern France. Was a complete community that put into practice these ideas. And they had their initiates or their wise ones that lived amongst them. And again, the Catholic Church, you know, destroyed all of them. So in hopes of decimating, you know, the ideas, but ideas cannot be destroyed.
Yes, point well taken. Now, with the advent of the printing press in 1440, things began to change. And again, we think that Tsongkhapa's influence, that impulse, about 50 years earlier. So these ideas now were, and books became available, still to the rather well-to-do, but definitely you didn't have to have a monk transcribe on sheepskin anymore. It was much more affordable, and these ideas could be disseminated to a wider public, and of course the educated could then have discussion with other people who may not have been literate, but that doesn't mean that they were not intelligent, because it, you know, it's just us, you know, especially. So these ideas gained currency, and then of course you had the Reformation, where the church, it was not the final word anymore on everything, not the final authority, because there were many other sources of information, and there were other people questioning. And so there was a renaissance, a rebirth of the dead Middle Ages, because most people were, in a sense, mentally dead.
And to go back to the comment about the Cathars, one of the interesting things that was said with that comment was how these ideas continue to go forward. We've had quite a few meetings on the idea of what is real truth. And that's one of the sayings for Theosophy is about truth. So if it's true, if it's real truth, it is true for all ages, not just for each particular time period in the world. So we can see that these ideas are going back thousands of years and they're still the same. So we can see that the philosophy of Theosophy is real truth.
And these isolated Theosophists that were brave enough to speak out against the powers that be, they all paid for with their lives. So they were very brave. They're part of the sacred tribe of heroes. So that was the penalty. If you speak the truth, you lose your life. And it is kind of interesting that the same inquisitor, Cardinal Bellarmine, for Giordano Bruno, was also for Galileo, who kind of made a semi-apology. And he's still revered among the Jesuits. There's a building named after him on St. Joe's University campus. And so he was a champion of churchly oppression, is what he was. And he sadly is still revered in some circles.
Plotinus, who wrote down much of Ammoniosarchus' ideas, he says, when we look outside of that on which we depend, we ignore our unity. Looking outward, we see many faces. Looking inward, and all is one head. If a man could but be turned about He could see at once God in himself and the all.
MDW?
Yeah, so really one of the big ideas that all of these philosophers were talking about was the idea of God, you know, from a personal God to an impersonal God, to a universal God. So it's that battle is still going on.
Yes, it is still raging. Although we have the freedom to discuss these ideas, but we don't know if that's going to last. But as long as it's going, and as long as we, you know, there are cycles, like Boethius said about history being a wheel. It's inconstant. We rise with the spokes, but of course the spokes turn. So there's rises and falls. Mutability is our tragedy, but it is also our hope. The worst of times, like the best, are always passing away. So that's why we live in the here and the now. We have these ideas, and it is our aim and purpose to spread, broadcast these ideas to the best of our ability. Not great philosophers, just students trying to articulate the ideas. That is all. SL had your hand up, I think.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting trends of Western thought that was brought out this morning is the continuous tension between science and religion, that they've also seemed to be irreconcilable. It was brought out, the argument between the round and the flat earth in the earlier centuries. And of course, in the Middle Ages, these scientists were burned at the stake because they taught that the sun was at the center of the solar system and not the earth. And of course, today we still have the argument between creationism versus Darwinism. You know, what are we going to teach in the schools, and science or religion? So it's very interesting that these scholars and even in the modern theosophic movement tried to make science religious and religion scientific.
Right. Well, the church made a deal with Descartes to, you know, you can talk about science, but just don't tread on ours. So that we have that split, which it wasn't good for science or religion. It was, in a sense, a deal with the devil, as it were, the metaphorical devil. The real devil is our friend, because he's the opposer. So we've come to the end of the hour, but we could have one more comment if someone wants to make a comment at this time. Okay, well, we hope that, okay, one quick quote here from Hypatia to end it. Life is an unfoldment, and the future we travel, Life is an unfoldment, and the further we travel, the more truth we can comprehend. To understand the things that are at our door, it is the best preparation for understanding those that lie beyond. And we know she said it much better than that, but so our meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.